Welcome to the Diggin' Oak Island Podcast, a podcaster's journey to discover the truth behind the Oak Island mystery. I'm Dave McBride, and thank you for downloading and listening. For anyone looking to get into the Oak Island mystery, the obvious place to start is the discovery of the money pit itself. It is the origin story, so to speak, for the treasure hunt. The tale so often told is of a teenager paddling out to an uninhabited island by himself in the spring of 1795 and discovering strange things that made him think pirates had buried treasure there. But like almost everything related to Oak Island, it's not as straightforward as we might think. I think the best way to begin our look at the discovery of the money pit is to reach back to how the story was told in 1965 by that Reader's Digest article Rick Lagina credits for igniting his interest in the island's mystery. It's probably the most popular and still the most often repeated of what happened on that fateful day. So the article reads like this, and I quote, "Daniel McGinnis, a 16-year-old from Chester, Nova Scotia, paddled over to uninhabited Oak Island to hunt for game. On a knoll at one end of the island, he noticed an odd depression. Above it, on a sawed-off tree limb, hung an old ship's block and tackle. McGinnis's heart raced, for in the nearby point of Le Havre, once a lair for pirates preying on New England shipping, he had heard many legends of buried treasure. The next day, he came back with two other boys, Anthony Vaughn and John Smith, and began digging." Now, let's stop there. The rest of it goes into a lot of different specifics about, you know, what happened, what the boys did, and then the article itself, which we talked about in the last episode. So you can go back and listen to that. The article itself kind of covers a whole sort of range of everything up to 1965 in Oak Island. But let's talk about its telling of the discovery. Is that really how it happened? Well, there's no way to really know for sure, but let's take some time here to see how close to the truth we can actually get. Now, before we get into the details of what we know of the discovery of the money pit, let us first admit that there are a few issues inherent in the retelling of the story that make it darn near impossible to get to the actual truth. There's a few here. Before 1795, Oak Island already had mystery surrounding it. The local legend had it that the island was haunted. I mean, this dates back to early in the 18th century. There was a story of two men disappearing after heading out to the island to investigate mysterious lights. And that was probably the most popular of these legends, but there were others. Either way, everyone involved at this point in the story would be well aware of the trepidation that surrounded the island. It's often said that it was these tales that made it difficult for the original searchers to find anyone willing to go to the island and help with the dig. We're also talking about an entire area filled with stories of pirates prowling the coast and hiding their treasure on the dozens of largely uninhabited islands dotting the waters off Nova Scotia. In fact, according to the Canadian Encyclopedia, Mahone Bay, which is the area that Oak Island is in, is derived from the French Mahone, referring to a long, low boat used by pirates who frequented the area. So pirates are really a big part here. Legends of marauders like Ned Lowe and, of course, Captain William Kidd are part of the very fabric of life throughout Atlantic Canada. And with pirates always comes superstition, you know? Nary a pirate story can be told without spinning a supernatural yarn of ghosts and curses. So once folks started to hear of something buried on Oak Island with booby traps and coded messages, can only assume that the imagination of those hearing and retelling the story added their own touch of these same kind of pirate flavors to it. It's also worth noting that Oak Island got its name for a really good reason. It's the only one in that area of Mahone Bay covered in oak trees, making it look unique even just from seeing it from the shoreline. So even without tales of ghosts or strange lights or demon dogs, and yes, you heard that one correctly, we'll get to that in a future episode, Oak Island was a peculiar place, especially for a time period and a population prone to superstition. These mysteries were already ingrained into the island before any idea of buried treasure came came into the picture. So we simply must conclude that these things bore some influence upon how the original story of the discovery of the money pit was passed down through the generations. What I mean is, we have an already spooky island, and now we have something truly confounding discovered on that very same island. So imagine you have what everyone says is a haunted house on your block up the street. A group of kids go in it on a bet, only to find that there's jewelry or cash or a Picasso hidden behind the sheetrock. What kind of crazy stories might develop out of that? The truth is a lot more likely that you had an old house that was owned by an art collector or someone who was afraid of getting robbed. But just imagine what that would turn into over the years. It makes it really difficult to separate fact from fiction decades later after the local lore has taken hold of the story. Another rather obvious issue is the timing of the discovery of the money pit. It goes without saying this took place in the years before the internet and photographs or those kind of ways to document history. We have no pictures and we have no immediate third party reporting either. I mean, it's not like McGinnis ran off to the authorities or the local newspaper to let them know what he found, which, let's face it, would be a really stupid move for someone convinced a treasure lies beneath. It's hardly a good idea to broadcast that information to everyone around. This was also a remote place comparatively for the 18th century, a small fishing village quite a distance away from Halifax or any other large towns or cities. So the story took time to make its way into the general consciousness. And with that time, details change. Also, time obviously makes it harder and harder to get to the bottom of these stories. As the years pass by, the truth gets more and more obscured behind the imagination of those telling the tale. It also doesn't help that all the facts behind the discovery of the money pit was not even that consistent 150 years ago, when the people who were involved in the actual discovery, or certainly their contemporaries and children, were still around. But we'll get into that a little more in just a second. Okay, now there's another subject involving this time period that I kind of feel the need to get into. There's this movement, though the word might be a bit of an exaggeration, about questioning whether Daniel McGinnis, the man, ever really existed at all. When you look into the 1795 discovery of the money pit, you inevitably run into this idea that Daniel McGinnis was the creation of the other two searchers, Smith and Vaughn, for some, you know, conspiracy type of reasons I just really don't want to get into. And they aren't very consistent anyway. It's probably accurate to say that the paper trail on Daniel McGinnis might be a bit thin or maybe has some gaps in it. There's also confusion about how old he actually was. That might be based on the fact that his father bore the same name, and it can be difficult to know which Daniel McGinnis, you know, these old records are referring to. But in the 18th century in Maritime Canada, that isn't really proof of anything that there's holes in the paper trail or this kind of confusion. McGinnis is certainly not the only person of his era who has a somewhat incomplete paper trail. Anyone who has spent time on Ancestry, on an Ancestry search, can attest to that for sure. The discoverer Daniel McGinnis died in 1827. It was 30 years before Smith, and Vaughan lived a couple of years after Smith. Just to give this some perspective, this is before anything like treasure was found, like the gold chain links pulled up. We're going to get into all this, you know, in future episodes, but those of you who are familiar know what I mean. Those first sort of chain links that were pulled out, that was decades after Daniel McGinnis had died. It's also a long time before the money pit really gained any international recognition. The earliest reports, which we're going to discuss in a bit, are from the middle of the 18th century, so you're talking decades later. Most of what we know about McGinnis is what Vaughan and Smith, and the descendants of those three men, passed along through various reports of other folks involved with the search. This immediately throws up the red flags associated with second and third hand information. It's a naturally skeptical reaction, but it doesn't seem to be the correct one in this case. These sorts of things lend themselves to a conspiracy theory about McGinnis, but I'm fairly comfortable in saying that this is just a theory at best. It's all this really is. There is plenty of evidence that Daniel McGinnis not only existed, But him being the man who, you know, to essentially discover the money pit also seems to be a consistent part of the story that's told across the decades by many different people. As we already mentioned, time can certainly cloud the view of history. So you would think that the earliest tellings of the money pit's discovery would be more accurate and certainly more consistent than those of later years. But you'd be wrong. Let's take a look at three of the earliest records regarding the discovery of the money pit. These are certainly not the only three records available from the 18th century, from the 19th century, but I kind of feel they're the best of the bunch, and they offer a nice sort of variety of perspectives, which we'll get into as we get through it. The first one I want to point out is an article written in the Liverpool Transcript, which was a newspaper, and this article appeared on October 16th of 1862. This is one of the earliest newspaper stories I can come up with, and while this appeared in a British paper, it was not actually written by a reporter, as far as I can tell. It's an account written by a man named J.B. McCulley, who was, in fact, involved in the search itself. He was listed as the manager and drilling engineer of the Truro Company, which was the principal search organization from 1849 through the early 1850s, and also as the corporate secretary of the Oak Island Association, which did the searching from 1861 until about 1864. While this correctly lends doubt to McCulley's account, let's keep in mind that as a member of the Truro Company, he would have worked and met with John Smith and Anthony Vaughan. So let's get into what to the part. Now, all of these things involve, they're written in the 1860s, so it's a, you know, they involve much more than just the discovery of the money pit. They list all the things discovered since then and you know, kind of fill in all the story up until that point. But I'm only going to focus on the discovery part, the part that deals with Mr. McGinnis, Smith, and Vaughan. So here is what the Liverpool Transcript says. And I'll stop in between this and let you know where I'm doing that. Quote, when the first settlers from the United States came to Chester, they brought with them a story that an old sailor, while on his deathbed, stated that he belonged to Captain Kidd's crew, and that he helped to bury on an island somewhere in that neighborhood about £2 million value of treasure, but that he had never dared to avail himself of the secret for fear of the law taking him as a pirate, end quote for now. First of all, there's just a quick mention in here of the first settlers from the United States. It's important to note that after the Revolutionary War, many loyalists from America settled in this area. We will talk about that a lot more as the you know, in future episodes. But just so you understand what that means, we mentioned the pirate stuff already. But this particular story of a deathbed confession certainly at least bears a comment or two. First, this is not the only place this story is told. It seems this was a legend known in the region and even made its way into the research of Gilbert Hedden, who helped to lead the treasure hunt in the 1930s. The details of this, where it took place, who this sailor was, has changed over the years, but still the same idea has been often repeated. Hedden links the origin of the story back to members of the Smith and McGinnis families who he claims were actually the ones to speak with this old sailor. Let's set this story aside for now and hopefully we can come back to it somewhere down the road. So I continue, quote, sometime after the arrival of these persons, a Mr. McGinnis went to Oak Island to make a farm. Let me just end quote there and stop. This is another reason why McGinnis is thought to have come to the island. First, we heard if we go back to what the Reader's Digest article said, he said he was there to hunt for game or something to that effect. This changes a lot in the story and is one of the things that really makes it difficult to kind of put your finger on what happened, because this seems like a pretty mundane detail, yet it's difficult to get it correct as time goes on. I continue, quote, when he discovered the spot in question from its being sunken and from the position of three oak trees, which stood in a rectangular form round the pit, the bark had letters cut into it, with a knife on each tree facing the pit, and one of the trees being so directly over the pit that two large branches formed a crotch, were exactly perpendicular to the center, and had a hole bored through, and an oak tree nail driven in, on which hung a tackle block. I'm going to stop quote there. I apologize for the way I'm reading this. It's a very difficult read aloud. this old way of writing with huge run-on sentences can be a little difficult for me, but I'm going to continue to do my best. I'll continue on. Quote, he was induced from the appearance to suppose that it might be the place referred to by the sailor. He then acquainted two men, Smith and Vaughn, of the circumstance, and they commenced digging. After going down 10 feet, they found a layer of oak timber, at 20 feet the same, and 30 the same. By this time, the work became too heavy for them to carry on all alone, and they tried to get the inhabitants to join them. But they refused from a kind of superstitious dread. Unquote. So that's our very first one from the Liverpool Transcript in October of 1862. It gives you kind of all the bullet points of McGinnis and Vaughan and Smith, and obviously a lot of time has been sunk into a couple of paragraphs here. We're not going to get too much into the inconsistencies and some of the things that might change. We'll get into that as we go on. Okay, so let's go on to our next account. This one was written by Judge Mather B. Debrisay, which I hope I'm saying that correctly. I think I am. From his History of Lunenburg County, and it was released in 1870. Judge Debrisay was born in Chester in Lunenburg County, Nova Scotia in 1828. He was a lawyer. He went into politics. He eventually became the Speaker of the House of the Assembly of Nova Scotia and later served as a county court judge for Lunenburg County. He was also a locally famous collector of historical artifacts, and in 1870, he published a book entitled The History of the County of Lunenburg. And let's face it, even in 1870, you certainly couldn't talk about local history without mentioning Oak Island. Now, as far as I can tell, and this is a lot of conjecture on my part, but it seems to be that Debrisay has very little to gain by exaggerating the claims of Oak Island, which I think is because this is just a small portion of a large book. It wasn't written about Oak Island. It was just a mention in here. And I think this kind of makes his account probably the most trustworthy account of how the history of the money pit was understood 75 years after the fact. This is an educated, connected, and measured guy communicating what he knows. To put that into some perspective, imagine trusting someone in 2019 who you know is a smart, learned, educated person who's writing on events that happened in 1944. It simply isn't hard to imagine that his account is pretty darn close to accurate and that his sources are usually pretty good. But, as we'll see, hearsay plays a part in the judge's writing, even if only a little bit. It does play a part here as well. So let's begin. Quote, among the islands, none is more widely known than Oak Island, 4 miles from Chester, so called from the beautiful oak trees, some of which remain. I stopped there after the first sentence. So this gives us, in 1870, an example of, by this point, less than 100 years away, we have now gotten to the point where it is widely known, according to the judge. So there's interest in Oak Island throughout the area and probably even beyond. This is after the Liverpool Transcript article. There were other articles as well. So there is now a focus on Oak Island, and the judge acknowledges that for us. I continue. It has become famous for the searches from time to time made for treasure supposed to have been buried by the noted pirate Captain Kidd. Let's stop again. Another example of how the Captain Kidd theory was just the active assumption for many, many years. There wasn't theories. There weren't any ideas of this, that, or the other thing. This was supposed to be Captain Kidd's treasure, and people just assumed that. And I continue. The first settlers were John McMullen and Daniel McGinnis, father of Mrs. Thomas Whitford of Chester. I have to stop again. I promise I'll get more than a sentence at a time here. This lists McGinnis as one of the island's first settlers, and not someone who happened to just row over there for fun. I'm assuming that this is the Daniel McGinnis who discovered the money pit. It's perhaps a relative of his. He doesn't really clarify that. So let's continue. The pits hereinafter referred to were dug on the farm formerly owned by John Smith, who was born in Boston, Mass. On August 20th, 1775, and died on the island after a residence there of 71 years on the 29th of September, 1857. Sorry, I told you I was going to get more than a sentence, but I can't, because what this does is give us an age for John Smith. If he was born in 1775, he was 20 years old when this was discovered. And in 1795, 20-year-old is by no means considered a boy or a child. So this is a man. And so we already get back to, that original Reader's Digest article that refers to them as boys. According to the judge, these were not boys. I continue. He brought up his children very respectfully. His daughter, Mary, lived in the family to which the writer belongs for 16 years, and he takes pleasure in here mentioning her name, remembering with gratitude her faithful attention in the days of his childhood at Chester and afterwards at Dartmouth. So it would certainly seem to me that John Smith's daughter was probably a nanny or a house servant or something to Debussy. Her name is Mary Smith, and if nothing else, it seems that she might have been... Now, again, we're making an assumption here, but I would imagine she would have been a good source of information for the judge's work. So this is, Mary Smith would have known what happened through her father, we would assume. Let me continue. Several accounts have been given to the writer of work from time to time done on the island, and some of it he has himself witnessed. Here comes the hearsay, folks. The leading facts are embodied in the following condensed statement from lengthy papers published December 20th, 1863, and subsequently by a member of the Oak Island Association, who said that more than a century before, an old man died in what was then known as the British colony of New England, who on his deathbed confessed to having been one of the crew of the famous Captain Kidd and assured those who attended him in his last moments that he had many years previously assisted that noted pirate and his followers in burying over 2 millions of money beneath the soil of a secluded island east of Boston. This news having been widely spread, many searches were made, but all in vain. Okay, so let's stop for a second. Just as a reminder, the Oak Island Association, which he mentions before, was the company that was doing the searching in the early 1860s. It's the same company that J.B. McCullough, the man who wrote the Liverpool transcript account, was associated with and worked for. So it would seem to me, even though we have another 7 years later, or however many years later, another account of this Captain Kidd crewman deathbed confession, that he's just retelling this little portion that he probably read in the paper or that he's heard before. I'm only saying this because I don't want it to be thought that the judge's mentioning of this story makes it any less apocryphal. I just think he's communicating some of the color of the story. Let me continue. Three men, Smith, McGinnis, the grandfather of James McGinnis, and Vaughan, emigrated from New England to Chester. Smith and McGinnis took up land on Oak Island, and Vaughan settled on an adjacent mainland. McGinnis one day discovered a spot that gave evidence of having been visited by someone a good many years earlier. So let's stop. Here is a big reason why I just kind of like this account more than others. The judge says that McGinnis settled on the island and one day just saw something peculiar on the grounds in the woods. There's no strange lights. There's no curses. There's no uninhabited island. It's just a landowner who found something weird near his house. And to me, that makes it much more believable. And if that's the information that he got from his source, who was the daughter of one of these people, that seems to make a lot more sense. Let me continue. There had been cuttings away of the forest, and oak stumps were visible. One of the original oaks was standing, with a large forked branch extending over the old clearing. To the forked part of this branch, by means of a tree nail connecting the fork in a small triangle, was attached an old tackle block. McGinnis made known his find to his neighbors. Next day, the three visited the place, and on taking the block from the tree, it fell to the ground and went to pieces. Okay. I love this little detail about the tackle block falling to the ground and disintegrating because of his age. Apparently this was so old and so very rotted that, as soon as it was disturbed, it fell apart. If you don't know what a block and tackle is, it's sort of a pulley system. You would use ropes and wood blocks to be able to raise and lower things. You'd see these used quite a bit on ships to lower heavy items into the cargo holds below deck. And if you take a look at it, a block and tackle from that era, you would probably immediately associate it with maritime activity. But I want to make sure we point out that it is not the only place where a block and tackle would be used. While it does seem to be very sort of piratey and maritimey and, related to sailors, that's a tangential relation at best. This is not any proof that this was done by a pirate or anything like that. All it is proof that somebody may or may not have wanted to lower or raise something in that area. That's all it is. It's a cool piece of evidence, one whose existence is in question as the years go on and as you start to dig into this a bit, but I just wanted to point that part out. Let me continue. Quote, they found the remains of a road from the tree to the western shore of the island, and they concluded that if Kidd had buried money, it was probably here. The ground over which the block had been settled and formed a hollow. They cleared away the young trees and removed the surface soil for about 2 feet. When they stuck a tier of flagstones, which they found differed from the island stones, and concluded that they had been brought from the vicinity of the Gold River. Let me stop. The Gold River is a river you can probably see from the north side of the island anyway. Just to give you a little perspective, it empties into Mahone Bay right in this area, so it's not like these stones were coming from the other side of the world. There's another great little detail that he sort of goes by here, which is they cleared away the young trees, meaning that the older trees of the area, the old oak trees, had been taken down, destroyed, and in their place began growing these younger trees. And, I wish we had a little more detail on that, because how old these trees are would tell you how long it's been since that area was excavated or disturbed. Anyway, I continue. On removing these, they saw they were entering an old pit that had been filled up. The mouth was 7 feet in diameter, and the sides were of tough, hard clay. But the earth, which had been used in filling, was loose and easy to be removed. 10 feet lower was a tier of logs, tightly attached to the sides, and the earth below them had settled nearly 2 feet. The logs were very much decayed on the outside. Removing these, they went 15 feet farther down. To get below this, they required help, but none seemed willing to assist. Okay, that's the end of Judge D'Abrissé's sort of account of the discovery of the money pit. Okay, there's a couple things in there in that last section that are worthy of mentioning anyway. First, I love the detail of the sides were tough and hard and the oak logs, decaying and all that. But there's one little discrepancy here, which is that he said that they dug down 10 feet, found the first tier of logs, and then dug down another 15 feet before they figured they were down way too far. And I can only imagine these guys, first of all, the amount of effort it takes to dig 25 to 30 feet but with hand shovels into the ground is just monumental. I mean, my back hurts just thinking about it. But I can only imagine digging your own little hole, 30 foot hole, and looking up and thinking to yourself, okay, I think I need professionals here. So while I talked earlier about how this account might be the most accurate of the early accounts, considering the writer, we have to question some of the information as well. how much of it is simply taken from the same sources as the others? Did the judge do any independent sourcing for this account? Is this based on knowledge given to him by the daughter of John Smith? We hinted about this before, or from a member of the search company, looking for funding and investors. These are good questions. I can't answer them. So while I like this account better, the same questions can arise around the credibility of it. And that brings me to yet another completely unanswerable question. Dave Ramsey was a serious guy, but as all of us who are interested in things like the Oak Island Mystery can attest, serious guys don't always take these kinds of things seriously. Is the judge really digging into the subject to report the most accurate truth surrounding the search? Or is he just retelling what he thinks is a tall tale with kind of a tongue-in-cheek attitude and without really giving it a whole lot of thoughtful research? It's as though he's researching the great history of this county, and then there's this funny little story that he just wants to throw in because, as he says in the beginning, it's the most famous and you really can't talk about it unless, you mention Oak Island. It's hard to say. And I'm not sure I really can say either way. I would hope his relationship with the Smith family would cause him to take his information, to take this kind of information seriously. But it isn't so hard to believe that someone like the judge would consider the whole Oak Island thing kind of silly. So let us now discuss our third and final retelling of the discovery of the money pit. This one comes from the Oak Island Treasure Company's public share offering in 1893. The Oak Island Treasure Company, which started that same year, 1893, it's the organization whose members included Frederick Blair and William Chappell. Those are two of the true legends of the Oak Island treasure hunt. The information given in the report I'm about to read comes from the company's initial attempt to help promote investment into the company. So if you picture now, Rick and Marty Lagina and Craig Tester and maybe Dan Blankenship and this group of people who are funding the dig, it's privately funded, we would say, to use that expression. But all the companies involved over the years have not been always privately funded. They've often had to get shareholders in order to fund the digs. And that's what this is basically doing, a public share offering, is soliciting shareholders. So it's absolutely within anyone's right to question the potential exaggerated nature of the following claims. But having said that, the introduction of the report actually says the following. Quote, "Much fiction has been written concerning great sums of money and vast quantities of jewels buried by pirates some 200 years ago, somewhere along the Atlantic coast. Our story has to do only with fact, as stated by the men now living and who had a hand in them, or as told to them by men now dead." End quote. It then goes on. So it says that this is only fact. It then goes on to list things it claims, quote unquote, can be proven, including, quote again, "at the bottom of this shaft," he's referring to the money pit, were placed large wooden boxes in which were precious metals and jewels. And, quote, "it is reasonably certain that the treasure is large because so great a trouble would never have been taken to conceal any sum," end quote. Can be proven. Remember that. So the ridiculous exaggerations begin before we even get past the first two paragraphs. But in the process of tracking sort of the ever-changing story surrounding the money pit's discovery, this still remains an important stopping point, an important document on that journey. So let's talk about what it says about the discovery, shall we? And let's begin. The first sentence reads, "About the close of the last century, this part of the country was very sparsely populated, and the island in question was without an inhabitant." Okay, so let's stop here. So what we're talking about, now obviously we're going to discuss this notion of being uninhabited. Let's go back to Judge DeBrusset's excerpt from his book, where he says that the first settlers were John McMullen, Daniel McGinnis, and Daniel McGinnis. These were listed as settlers. So that implies that people were living there at the time. So it's important to note that whether or not the island was inhabited is certainly not agreed upon by every historian, certainly not even ones 100 and over 100 years ago. We have records that show that the land and the island was divided into plots in the 1760s. On the show, you hear a lot about these plots and the numbers. Even though the land was owned for much of the time between the first survey of the island and the discovery of the money pit, it's possible that for a lot of that time, it may only have just been used to pasture cattle or something like that. It does seem pretty clear, though, that by 1791, the island was inhabited and being farmed, and that John Smith himself may have been living on the island for years. The Oak Island Tours Incorporated, this is the current search company owned by the Lagina brothers and their partners, says on their very website that the, quote, 1791 poll tax record show Oak Island was inhabited and being farmed, unquote. I mention this because I think it's important to note that in these early tellings, it is the most recent one, the one where we cannot credit the source of the information to the original discoverers themselves, that calls the island uninhabited. Is this because they just made a mistake, or are they trying to make the island seem more mysterious at the time of the legend's beginning? Again, the mistake could just be that for a lot of that time, it was uninhabited, and maybe they got the time frame wrong as to when people actually started to live on the island rather than just own land on the island. It's one thing to find a strange man-made feature in someone's backyard, but it's something entirely more intriguing if that same man-made feature is found on an uninhabited island. So you see why calling it uninhabited, if it were a mistake, is certainly a convenient one. Maybe in future episodes we can get more into the early history of Oak Island, but who lived where and when they bought and that kind of stuff. And there's a lot of information on that out there, and maybe we will get into that in the future. But let's continue with this. Quote, in 1795, three men, Smith, McGinnis, and Vaughn, visited the island, and while rambling over the eastern part of it, came to a spot of which the unusual and strange conditions at once engaged their attention. Mr. Vaughn himself, and this is in parentheses, who was only a lad of 16 at this time, subsequently related these facts to Mr. Robert Creelman, who still lives at Upper Stewiacke, I don't know how to pronounce that, Nova Scotia, and who was afterwards the manager of a company formed to recover the treasure. My apologies for anyone from Nova Scotia if I cannot pronounce some of these town names. So let me stop here. This detail seems to be added to kind of show the veracity of the claims. You could see why he's, Mr. Vaughn said this to this person who's still alive and who we can talk to. But the claim hardly stands up now. while rambling over an uninhabited island, it doesn't seem like if this is who he got the information from, maybe he should wonder whether or not that information is for real. Let me continue. It had every appearance of having been cleared many years before. Red clover, great little detail there, and other plants altogether foreign to the soil in its natural state were growing. Near the center stood a large oak tree with marks and figures on its trunk. One of the lower and larger branches of this, the outer end of which had been sawed off, projected directly over the center of a deep circular depression in the land about 13 feet in diameter. These and other signs, which it puts in quotes, shortly after led the three men to commence work. So let's just stop there for a second. I mentioned that the red clover was a great little detail, and the plants altogether foreign to the soil is a popular sort of refrain that happens, that the trees around Oak Island are not indigenous to the island itself. I'm not a horticulturalist, but that seems to be that, it is, I shouldn't say not indigenous. It is the only island in the area with those oak trees on it. This seems to sort of say that other things were planted besides the trees. It's a weird detail. It's one that I don't find in a lot of other places. I actually haven't found it in any other places, but I'll keep looking for sure. So I just wanted to point that out, that maybe we're just sort of pushing this idea of strange and exhaustive work being done here on the island. Let me continue. After digging a few feet, they found that they were working in a well-defined shaft, the walls of which were hard and solid, and is said that in some places old pick marks were plainly to be seen, while within these walls the earth was so loose that picks were not required. On reaching a depth of 10 feet, they came to a covering of oak plank. They kept on digging until a depth of 30 feet was reached, finding marks at each 10 feet. At this point, the work proved to be too heavy for them. Superstitious beliefs were in full force in that part of the country at the time, and on this account, they were unable to get any help to continue the work and were forced to abandon it. We end here with a mention of that's the end of the sort of discovery portion of this account. We end with this mention of the superstition again on the island, being the reason these men found it hard to find help digging. You know, maybe one day myself or someone else can actually look into the Oak Island mystery. We'll take the time to really dig in and question this claim. It seems to be a popular claim. I'm not saying it's untrue. It certainly is one of the most consistent details of the story of the discovery of the money pit, but it can only be hearsay at best. I found no examples of anything specific, no names of people turning down offers or the like, just this claim that the three guys who found the money pit also found it hard to get help because people were scared of the island. Doesn't seem hard to believe from what we know of the island, but it's just a sort of unsubstantiated detail. And since we already know that the island was inhabited, was it really that scary a place to area residents by 1795? Again, it's hard to say. Is this story covering some other truth, some other reason why they couldn't get help, or some other reason why there was a delay in continuing the work? It's really, really hard to say, but it's something worth questioning, I think. Okay, so as we finish with all three, let's just remember that both the Liverpool Transcript and the Oak Island Association articles were written by people with a vested monetary interest in stoking excitement around the Oak Island treasure hunt, since they would directly benefit from that. I think it's also really important to keep that in mind whenever you see stories from Oak Island. There's a lot of consistency here. For instance, the idea that a tree branch was hanging over the depression appears in all three tellings, among other elements. And while it's true that some of the details might appear in one account, not the other, it seems that that's likely more a result of omission, I would hope, rather than an inconsistency in the story. For example, the Liverpool Transcript and the Judge bear the only two mentions of the tackle block, while the Transcript and the Oak Island Treasure Company are the only two to mention scratched letters on the trees by the pit. I guess I would say that I think there's some consistency here, but I'm just not so sure if that consistency adds to the believability of the overall story, or is it just kind of raise questions about the variety of the sources they use to get their information. The fact is that none of these, even though we have pointed out some exaggerations or mistakes, none of these accounts seem to embellish all that much, except for perhaps the Oak Island Treasure Company for the reasons we mentioned earlier. I said this before, there's no mention of cursed treasures, there's no paranormal lights, there's no strange stuff. So it's just kind of a good look at how it's changed over time. Now, we get that, and in the first couple of accounts, we didn't have the uninhabited islands, the uninhabited island, and that added. So you can see how over the years, these other things have been added to it. I think it's also important to mention that all three of these reports refers to McGinnis, Smith, and Vaughan as men and not boys. They're often referred to as boys in later history of the island. That's just something worth noting. So what do we know for sure? After all this talk about issues and potential errors, it seems we can have a few things, we can say a few things about the story with some level of certainty. Here are five elements that we can focus on for our conclusions. One, Daniel McGinnis found a spot in the woods on Oak Island which contained an unusual depression in the ground and missing trees surrounding it. It appeared out of the ordinary to him. He was obviously someone familiar with the area. Number two, this led him to get two friends, John Smith and Anthony Vaughan, to come and have a look. Number three, we know for sure, the local lore of pirate treasure throughout these surrounding waters compelled these three guys to start digging in the area. Number four, seems consistent that they found evidence they were digging in an already dug out shaft, including at least one covering or tier of wood planks that was not natural, and maybe even more than one tier. And number five, they continued digging a bit further until realizing that this job that three men could not do by themselves, and they set off on what was a lifelong search to find the truth. It's absolutely true that over the years since 1795, the story of the discovery of the money pit has changed, evolved, been exaggerated, and so on. Time has predictably lent its own flavor to it. But if the original story we know now only included these five most consistent elements I just listed, no one would ever question the need to start a serious dig in the area. So I suppose my conclusion to all this is, don't let the silly stuff added years later by people not named McGinnis, Smith, or Vaughn detract from what these three men claim to have discovered. We talk now about centuries of people who've become obsessed with this search. McGinnis, Smith, and Vaughn are the first in that long line. I can only assume that they had good reasons to dedicate the rest of their lives to this treasure hunt. So that's it for this episode of Digging Oak Island. Please subscribe to the show anywhere you get your podcasts. And if you enjoy the show, please rate and review us on iTunes or wherever you listen. You can also follow us on Facebook. We are at Digging Oak Island. Give us a like there. It helps keep up with the show that way. If you have any questions or comments that you want to send straight to me, you certainly can do so via email at diggingoakisland@gmail.com. That's Digging Oak Island, no G at the end of digging. diggingoakisland@gmail.com. So until the next time, I'm Dave McBride. Thank you for listening to Digging Oak Island.